Other People's Flowers is a podcast for stories, poetry, and essays. Thank you for listening.
This week's work comes from Jamie Lung. Jamie is a writer living in Los Angeles. Glimpse. She had braved the rain while still in her bedtime camisole, tucked hastily into her skinny jeans as it peered out a blue raincoat. Her makeup was done in the cab, and she already tasted the lead stain of red on her front teeth. She moved swiftly, like a moment of colour among the parade of black umbrellas. The gothic design of the private high school rekindled her longing to see, paint, and breathe Paris. Yet the school glared down at her with disdain. Before she stepped inside, already very late, she saw a malnourished cyclist toppled onto the pavement, shouting at a cab with unbridled savagery. The schoolgirls didn't like her. They whispered in their own conversations and stuck headphones in their ears. She remembered the cyclist and persisted with the mediocre analysis of their readings. When she returned to her apartment, she turned the dial of the radio until the notes of Nocturne No. 9 expanded into the room like carbonated bubbles. The night folded its sunset like an umbrella behind the opposite row of apartments. She sank deeper into a nap with the accumulating darkness, until she was in freefall with the glittering rise and collapse of scales, chords, and arpeggios. He was a tall, bookish figure who looked a little out of place, in a way that you should find him in the 1920s with slicked black hair and a well-tailored suit absorbing a line of ticker tape. As a Wall Street stockbroker with undeniable charisma, he appeared content and moved with direct purpose, subdued by modesty. At the end of another meeting, he parked his briefcase by an invisible desk, overpopulated with neatly printed documents, books corrupted by his loose, distinct scrawl on the margins, and whiskey glasses tinted with amber. When he pushed down the window to eliminate the evening chill, he saw her for the first time. A story materialized at the back of his mind. She was a beautiful muse. Suddenly, she jolted awake. Her hands skimmed the bed for her cell phone before she tucked the device at the crook of her neck. He heard her apologizing loudly on the phone while flying across the room, looking for the black top. "Just let me find it and I'll be right there." She knocked over a tray of makeup, and the light from his apartment caught her attention. "I think my neighbor wants to file a noise complaint." She ducked under the open window and realized his tie was the wrong color and he was quite handsome. "Are you spying on me? People can hear you all the way on Mars." "It's not like you were there." "Maybe I was," he replied casually. "And then I flew all the way back here to tell you how loud you were." She shut her curtains. When she peered between the gap, he had done the same. She smiled, amused. She remembered Jeffrey, and then the interrupted phone call with Kaya. "Sorry, I'll be there in 5 minutes." The window became their personalized game and portal into each other's lives through scattered glimpses. As he fastened his tie for work, he saw her burn herself with coffee. The wispy, opaque curtains darted in rash movements at the wind's mercy, until she forced the glass screen down with all the strength her slender frame could provide. After a long day at work, when one too many schoolgirls threatened to sue, she would settle on the futon, chatting idly on her cell phone. Their eyes met on occasion, and she would lift her glass of red as a silly, sarcastic gesture. On Sundays, he read the paper with a double espresso after an early jog and left to play golf with co-workers at exactly 2:45. Having frequent fits of insomnia and a natural aptitude to entertain, he directed his agitation towards writing, spinning captivating stories with ease. When she felt lonely, she threw large gatherings of co-workers and whoever wanted to appear and, as expected, calamity ensued. Once, in a passionate rant, she accidentally flung a bottle over the balcony rail and watched it smashed violently against the pavement, a few inches behind a very alarmed Pomeranian. She considered inviting him, but valued the allure of mystery and preferred that he sacrifice the first pawn on the checkerboard. On these nights, he watched the strange faces and the occasional uproar information worthy of blackmail all across his apartment, and he decided the evening details within his stories. He was pulled aside by his boss the next morning, who asked that he close a deal with a client by the end of the month. There were hints of a promotion, and he loved a difficult challenge. She picked up Jeffrey from the airport, a boyfriend who used to pursue her madly, irrationally. She used to be amused by Jeffrey's hilariously earnest emails, which reeked with so much desperation they must have been satires of themselves. Although Jeffrey's endearing passion never faded, he began to disappear from time to time. She once asked him, jokingly, if he was a time traveller. "I am," he replied, while packing for another alleged business trip. "But I got those earrings for you. I found them while I was fighting the Germans." Jeffrey became her worst vice, until her partner bent on one knee and reached into his coat pocket with a practiced smile. All that she could muster, under the swinging fairy lights, brighter, closer than stars which observed from a distance, the dense air of Jeffrey's chloroform cologne and the loud, stifling quartet surrounding them with expectant eyes, was a faint, uncertain, "Yes?" The next morning, she blinked awake with the ring glimmering on her fourth finger, the tangible token proving her fiancé's visit wasn't simply an unsettling dream. He was plagued by insomnia. The glow from her desk lamp briefly thawed the innate coldness which settled since his adolescence. He could barely remember feeling as vividly as his fictitious characters since his childhood. He had grown up on a farm in the Midwest, where the days blended seamlessly into a single memory of rustling wheat fields as he and his sister combed through its golden stalks. He pursued that distinct weightlessness in his stories through various plots and styles, but couldn't recover the same feeling. That airy emptiness was lost when his sister died his final year in high school. He questioned the unexplainable event that stared so tangibly back at him, ugly and naked next to his life of tidy schedules and tasks marked out in neat lines. He watched from afar, detached, as the world continued without a moment's hesitation in his sister's absence. In his parents' eyes, he seemed to have crept out from the grip of depression, graduated, and began his freshman year at Harvard. After the fleeting 4 years, he and his friends were framed into crisp suits and dispersed among different companies, some across the nation and overseas. Sometimes he wondered exactly when he had become a spectator in his own life, never to interfere or burden himself against natural progression towards solitude. He crushed the end of his cigarette and dismissed his loneliness. Her silhouette contented him. The sight of her working late into the night forged a level of comfort that assuaged his dissatisfactions. The next morning, she spied a foreign laptop camouflaged with her stack of books. After a moment's hesitation, she opened it and glanced through Jeffrey's emails. Her plummeting disappointment from an unsavoury discovery confirmed her suspicions. As she clicked through one of the woman's pictures on Facebook, the dangling brass flower on the model's ear, decked with delicate rhinestones, stabbed her with nauseating recognition. It was the exact pair Jeffrey had given her weeks prior. As she struggled to console herself, she tried to reason that she no longer had to unconsciously compete against the three other women sleeping with Jeffrey. Had she managed to acquire multiple personalities, she would not have satisfied the demands of possessing three different bodies, which seemed to be the most pressing concern to her ex-fiancé. She tried to call him and declare it was over, but she couldn't manage past the second ring. On a Saturday evening, his boss randomly called him for work. As he ducked into the seat of the cab, she snatched the door and sat next to him. He glanced at her, a little startled. She was quite a spectacle, with the sticky black rivulet smeared across her cheeks and clumps of mascara residue below her waterline. She apologised curtly to him. There was a wine stain on her lace camisole, but in his eyes, she was her own interpretation of Audrey Hepburn. "It's just a bad time." She waved away his pity. That was the entire conversation of the taxi ride. Her eerily stoic composure silenced him. However, their unusual proximity allowed him to observe her profile, following the lines that divided her collarbone, shaped her arms, and then smoothed out in her lean calves. He liked the way her delicate fingers collapsed idly against each other in her lap, one of them caught in a silver band. He liked how she tamed the atmosphere and relieved an otherwise awkward silence into a soothing affair. He liked the contemptuous arch of her brow and the fullness of her upper lip, slightly swollen like a child's. He liked everything about her. "Right here should be fine." She paid the cab fare before he could object and left. Throughout the entire meeting, he tried to focus and struggled against drifting back to the taxi. They ran into each other again when he was on his way to the laundromat, contemplating over an ugly dispute from work. She shifted the weight of her belongings. "So we meet properly." He was suddenly overtaken by shyness. "That brown tie doesn't do it for you," she skimmed through the crowd. He laughed and brought up the wine bottle incident, which she refused to acknowledge. Easy banter developed into rich discussions, and they wondered how two people can ever be so aligned in moments of mutual inspiration. He noticed the ring was gone, as she drummed her filed nails against the washing machine. She noticed that he noticed. He glanced at the ground bashfully before continuing their analysis on why portobello mushrooms were expensive and coveted despite their vile flavour. They shared the same obscure humour, admiration of 70s pop culture, extensive knowledge of controversial love affairs among historical figures, and of course, the disgust at portobello mushrooms. He told her he was free Monday afternoon if she would like to spend the day together. She recognised the first signs of her next emotional dilemma, and then told him it was a great idea. Their afternoon conversation stuck with her like the effects of a refreshing nap. She started going on brisk walks after supper, removed bookmarks from novels queued up for her attention, and attempted to enjoy her job by entertaining the brats. Their growing admiration of her became evident as they plagued their young teacher after school to discuss, very narcissistically, their own similarities with female heroines in their literary assignments such as Edna Pontellier, Madame Bovary, and sometimes even Ms. Havisham. She even occasionally substituted for the perpetually late French teacher as practice for her dream of Paris. She liked his practical, ambitious view of the world and adopted it to rise above her usual wishful mediocrity. This had been for the wrong reasons, partially in hopes of increasing their compatibility and her indirect method of pursuing him. She tried to subdue that intention and reassured herself that the notion was absolutely frivolous. But every time her eyes wandered across the window, he nourished the seed of an illusion, of something perfect and surreal. After delivering a controversial lecture on Madame Bovary, she was pestered by a romantic impulse. Her fatal decision included a smear of lipstick, two spritzes of perfume, and a breath of hesitation. The door opened on the third knock. "Hi," she smiled, and he decided that even if she were some sort of psychotic murderer, he would let her in. The planned dialogue crumpled in the back of his mind as the churning flicker of blue in her dark eyes drew him in like the evening tide. "Do you want to go canoeing?" The water tilted their boat in its open palm. They felt the afternoon drowsiness as the lines of the city melted into a shimmering mirage. "I'm leaving Manhattan soon." "Was it something I said?" "Yes. Good." She laughed. "I got a job in Lyon. I wanted Paris, but that would cost both my kidneys." She was mesmerised by him, perhaps by the sun-dappled glow from his unforgettable features and the bright, honest eyes, but even more so by the unobstructed sincerity which forgave the constraints of their early acquaintance. "Thoughts on moving?" "It's all right." The wall of buildings lined up for her selection. "It's a modest place." She pointed to the silver skyscraper with chiselled windows. "It's the wimpy glass tower right there." "Wow, you've definitely settled." "Money's tight." He shaded his eyes. "Well, I guess I'll choose the second best building over there." "We're across from each other again." "Are you in the East Egg or the West?" It was a Gatsby reference, an inside joke from a previous conversation. "You belong in the West Egg. You and your crazy parties." A faint sunburn crept along her grin. "You probably throw parties as well, but no one ever shows up." "Never," he laughed. I would be Nick Carraway, the hermit. The loneliness never gets to you? He wondered how to present himself, but when their glances settled into each other, he realised it didn't matter. Sometimes. As they crossed into the shade beneath the bridge, the silhouette of each building flared into a wild amber, incinerated by the smeared sun across the horizon. The hopeful faces of the building turned towards the departure, hoping to be chosen. Her eyes filled with their reflections. The brighter the skyscrapers shone, the darker their shadows crept behind them, holding each back from evaporating with the dying light. When they returned to the apartment, the ripe afternoon had bled into evening. Her back pressed against the door as he felt the softness of her lips curl under his. "How long are you staying?" He looked at her like the first time they met. "My flight leaves at midnight on Wednesday. But do come over if you want, preferably around 6 or 7. After she crossed the little road and reached the 6th floor of her apartment complex, she ducked under the window. He mirrored her. His cheek was dusted with the soft violet sunset, whose beauty pierced her with nostalgia for pastel daydreams and recollections. The open wind carries traces of impending rain and combed back their hair so that the last of the sun touched their faces. He rifled through his drawer for a sheet of paper and wrote his contact information. He creased the sheet into neat lines of an airplane. The vessel arched and dipped towards her window. Had a light teasing breeze not interfered, the white bird would have landed just past her windowsill. Instead, the note dove headfirst into one of the trim, square bushes, firmly stationed amongst the chaos of twigs and leaves. "I'll get it later." Her voice was light and airy. "I'll see you then. I'll see you then," he echoed. Before he hurried back to the office, he tucked the story in his briefcase, in case he would forget the next time he saw her. A few nights prior, he had concluded that a fictitious world inspired by their series of encounters, he hoped she could see herself the way she appeared to him. His meeting was supposedly the next morning, but his client delayed their appointment twice, until late afternoon that Wednesday. The negotiation was more than a success. In fact, their client asked his team to join them for supper. She waited. He tried to end the occasion early, but there was no appropriate moment for an escape. She stared into her glass and lost herself in the slant of red. He finally hailed a taxi at 10 and realised he never asked her for her phone number. Leaning back in the cab seat, he imagined her packing right then, slowing down her actions in his head in hopes the lag would apply to reality. She stared at her luggage with an accumulating weight in her chest. Upon realising she had been a fool, she also admitted to being happiest then. She sought comfort in sad songs and lyrics which understood rejection, attempting to convince herself that her own company triumphed his. She turned the paper idly in her fingertips, brushing her thumb over the fold its wing which tucked away a note she would never find. He pulled into Heister Street and paid the cab driver too much without pausing for change. At exactly 10:25 he buzzed in and with desperate pleas and coaxes finally convinced a sleepy old man that he had simply forgotten his keys. She succumbed to busy ruminations in the taxi and stared out in the blurring lights, clinging onto the last spindles of hope that he would appear in the cab mirror like the male lead of a romantic comedy. She considered turning back and waiting for him in recollection of that afternoon. The reminiscing cut her deeper. Suddenly, she no longer wanted to be a fool, not even at the luxury of ignorance. He knocked on her door at 10:30, breathing hard from running up 6 flights of stairs. The folded paper plane remained stationed across his apartment window, but she stepped out from the taxi without looking back.
Thank you for listening to Other People's Flowers. Other People's Flowers is produced and edited by Hugo Gibson and Chris Kamonvutitam. If you enjoyed the show, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. If you'd like to have your work featured on the program, please visit otherpeoplesflowers.com to see our submission guideline. Thank you.